Session number 9280.
Rabbi Green, Reel 3.
They set up on the outskirts of the town. There were a couple of sawmills, large brick factory. They were all near each other. And in fact, the sawmill was one in which my father had an interest. You know, he was one of the owners of it. And that was the area designated to which the Jews will have to go. And in fact, were taken with a limited amount of baggage. And in a matter of about 2 or 3 days, Jews had to leave their homes, carts, trucks, all sorts of things came, driven by Hungarians, Hungarian troops, and the officialdom of the town was in complete cooperation with the Gestapo. There was no sign of any hesitation on their part. And we had to leave our beautiful home, move into, ironically, into the sawmill. I mean, in the shed. I hid some of my bar mitzvah presents, including my camera. And I did one of those very romantic gestures, I wrote a promissory note to myself that if we come through this thing in a positive or way, and that, I made all sorts of promises of what I might do. And actually hid that piece of paper under a huge log outside our kitchen. I found it there afterwards. On brown paper. I had the most dreadful premonition. I had become, at age 14, an extraordinarily cynical realist.
You anticipated genocide, you mean?
I don't know what I anticipated. No, I didn't. That I didn't. I couldn't. But I could see nothing redeeming. Now, not only were we taken into this ghetto, as it was called, but so were people coming from the villages. Villages were being emptied out of Jews, brought in there. Very quickly, and conditions there became very quickly very unpleasant. So much so that some of the people in town began to commit suicide, including one of our family doctors. And that, of course, just increased my depression. Then the announcements that, in fact, of course, this is just a stage in a resettlement program, and that actually the people from the ghetto will now be taken east to engage in agricultural work. And transports would begin momentarily, which they did. Now, the location of this ghetto, you can now see why, because, of course, both the sawmills and the brick factory had, of course, railway lines coming to them. And the trains, I mean, the closed cattle wagons, arrived. I can't remember how many trains, but they started to move out. Now, I was a nosy boy, and I nosed around these trains. This next bit never ceases to trouble me. I pulled off one of the wagons a slip of paper which gave the route. Britain. Beriksas. Prešov. Down in Slovakia. Krakow. Auschwitz. I think Auschwitz-Birkenau. I bring this piece of paper to my father. And he was having, they were just sitting around, he and some of his friends, and show it to them. And they look at it.
Did Auschwitz mean anything to you?
Nothing. That's the bizarre bit. This is 1944. Nothing. There is no way anybody, or not anybody, but there's no way we would have gotten on that train if those names meant anything. I don't know what we would have done, but we wouldn't have gotten on the train. Certainly, I would not. I mean, I know that categorically. And the bizarre thing is, okay, so that's, you see, that was in line with roughly B settlement, East, agricultural kind of sense. Do you not see there was a plausibility to this? Dreadful plausibility. Well, and then it was the turn of my family to get on the train. The journey must have taken at least 3 days. Stopped everywhere. Shunted this way, that way.
Under what conditions on the train?
Dreadful. There must have been 80, 90 of us in this one wagon. With a sort of latrine box and a barrel with water in it. Within hours, it was unmanageable.
Any food?
We took our own, still, whatever. Nothing handed in.
Were they covered wagons?
Oh, yes. Sealed and covered. With just two barbed wire kind of holes. Or little window things. We sat, we stood. I think at that point we also feared. This was not the way you take people to work camps. And when the train finally stopped, it was still dark. And we were at Birkenau. And they didn't open the trains until it was daylight. We got out. And that was the point where my own life was saved. There were these peculiar looking people, striped uniforms. I made the assumption at that point that they are sort of the inhabitants of the local lunatic asylum or something like that. Moving up and down. I mean, their job was, in fact, to clear the trains. But now one of them, as we were walking away from the train on this sort of wooden platform, and he's walking the other way, and as he's walking, he's muttering in Yiddish, "You're 18 and you've got a trade. You're 18, you've got a trade." And my father says to me, "If they ask you anything, you're 19. Tischler and Zimmerman, Carpenter and Joyner. That was my brother. That's the Gabriel in my name. He was 11. And quite small for 11. An extraordinarily lovely and very, very, very bright boy. And we come to the head of the line. And they ask, how old are you? And I say, 19. Hast dein Fach? Yeah, Tischler und Zimmermann. They don't even ask my brother. And he is sent in one way, my father and I in another, my mother in the same direction, roughly. And my grandmother, my grandfather, this was my mother's mother who happened to be with us. And other people, these little children, the elderly. And my mother is not going to let my brother go alone. You'll meet them later. I want to go with them. And the last I saw of her was her being pulled back and sent, as it were, roughly in our direction, although the men and women already separated there. And this, I can only describe surrealistic walk. So between the barbed wire fences. It's terribly clear, the image. The surrealistic part of it is, and please don't ask me to account for it because I don't know how, but that path was strewn with bizarre play on words in English, phylacteries and prophylactics. You know, I just realized the association of those two words. These leather straps that Jews wear for their prayers, and it must have been the people before us or whoever just threw them away. And condoms. Only the bizarre things I remember. There they were. Virtually until we came to this sort of clearing where we were told, line up, get undressed, leave your things in a neat pile here, move forward. It was quite warm by this time. Sun was out. Something else was happening, funnily enough. They were, and this is very clear, they must have been sort of experimental versions of those V2 rockets, because there were these streaks in the skies, you know, sort of air slips, and I almost felt some sort of divine intervention had to happen, and maybe. I can tell you, it was a very strange morning. So soon we were shorn of our hair completely, including a little bit of pubic hair I already had. Horrible pain when they put sort of disinfectant on the shaven parts. The barbers were Greek Jews. At least the one I had. Could talk to them, had no language, and went into this shower area, and it was a shower, came out at the other end, and given striped uniforms, wooden-soled shoes, ill-fitting, you know, and we looked like all those madmen on the platform. Taken to barracks. There were already people there. Not from our town. Other people, other Jews. And I conversation. And I asked what happens with reunion of families. You know, when are we going to meet with the women and the other people, the older people? How does it work? Now, this man, who had been there some time, said, well, you'll never see them again. I said, why not? He says, well, by now they're dead. So what do you mean they're dead? Look, I'm so scared. Don't make bad jokes for me. If you think I'm joking, think it. Would you believe it? I didn't believe what was happening there for at least 24 hours. I just didn't believe it. And then I did. But maybe 3 or 4 days later, I really was a very nosy kid. I went wandering around, and one of the guards just threw a packet at me. And said, take it, and put it in a certain direction. I did. And there I actually saw people from another transport arrive. And being herded into what I discovered later was, in fact, a gas chamber. That's where I would have to take that package.
What was the package?
I have no idea. It was a brown black package. By then, of course, I knew what that building was. But actually, you know, looking into it, and the crematorium right next to me, belching, smell. And one of the SS sort of prodding me, says, get over there. But I'm in a uniform. I said, well, I'm from such and such barrack. Oh, okay, then go back. I don't have to tell you how often I thought, well, you know, couldn't have been closer to it. I didn't really, that kind of didn't sink into me for some time. I guess that's the closest I you know, after that I had totally no illusions. Now, I have never quite remembered how many days we were there. I've tried to work this one out. A period of time, not very long. It was 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks at the most. Or maybe a little longer, I don't know. And clearly there was no meeting with the women and there was no meeting with anybody else. The next camp to us were people from Theresienstadt, and among them we had, in fact, even a cousin there. And we began to get stories, Theresienstadt and Lodz Ghetto and various other places and Dutch, everything. You know, it was a very cosmopolitan area. And the word was, the sooner you go out, the better. And a transport was being put together of skilled workers. And I was down, because they one went through sort of a second stage of suppose, registering, you know, getting sorted out. And I was still down as this Tischler and Zimmermann. And incidentally, so was my father. And he made himself younger. I think he admitted to being 35 or something like that. And so one morning, okay, all of you who are Tischlers, carpenters, and probably some other trades as well, step out. And we stepped out. Okay. Marched off on a train and taken out. Still sort of closed wagons, but no luggage this time. And taken to a place called Lieberosa, which is in Upper Silesia in Germany, near, I didn't know it at the time, but I've since then located it on the map, near Cottbus and Frankfurt am Oder, which was a work camp. And there I was given the number 80,494. You see, I do remember some numbers.
Had you been given a number in Birkenau?
No. At least I don't remember one. I don't think so. So I don't remember my number from Mauthausen, but that one I remember because I had to use it so often. And this was a small, you might say almost pretty camp in the forest, barracks. Some Germans there, Poles, Norwegians, everything, Czechs. It was a camp that belonged to the Sachsenhausen network. And the day after we got there, my career as a carpenter, as a joiner, came to an inglorious end. Perhaps because of my age, whatever, I was put as a mate with a Pole who was nicknamed Pilsudski, but certainly wasn't his name. I remember him because he landed me in it, to help him make benches in the camp. Everybody had to go out on work details outside the camp. And this Pilsudski, who had been a prisoner for a long time, decided he will skive off and let me get on with it. I had no idea what to do. There were boards, planks, hammers, saw, nails. And he disappears. I don't know what to do. Make benches. At which point, along comes one of the SS guards and says, first make some firewood for our guard room, for the stove, because they use it for heating, cooking. Was warm, it wasn't for warmth. Well, that I could do. So I proceeded to chop up all the boards I could and armload after armload. I mean, I spent the whole day chopping up this perfectly good building material into neat sections, and I built up in that guard room from floor to ceiling. Needless to say, by the time Pilsudsk came back and they looked at what I was doing, I was really slapped in the face. You idiot. How can you use for firewood this? You're no carpenter. Out. And that's how I ended my career as a carpenter. And then just went on from then on work details. There was an area which was near the railway where they were receiving and storing building materials. The main project of this camp was to build a place called Ullesdorf, which I think was meant to be a kind of holiday center or recuperation center for the army. In a forest, very pretty, and so big buildings were to go up there. I think anyone would have it completed. And that was sort of the main project. So everything had to do with some form of construction, building materials, and quarrying, and actually going out building. And various times I was assigned to those. At one point I was a laufer, a runner, which was a good job. As summer moved into autumn and winter, I mean, no need to go into all those details. I mean, you know, they're fairly common. But one episode, I think, will indicate something of the situation. For me, it's a paradigmatic story. To our extraordinary surprise, we worked 6.5 days a week, but Sunday afternoons were free. One Sunday afternoon, it is announced that we can write postcards wherever. And everybody is given a postcard. I don't know, it must have been about 4,000 people. Everybody is given a postcard. And pencil. Now that was unusual. It was one of those pencils where if you lick it, it becomes
indelible.
I'd become by this time very friendly with a man who was a Catholic priest, German, who was teaching me mathematics all the time. He was an astronomer, professor of astronomy before the war. And we never had anything with which to write. We used little bits of coal, sand, whatever, my car, you know. However, I sit down, and my father's with me. And I can write now a postcard to anyone, anywhere in the world. And I couldn't think of anyone to write.